This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Dave Davies in for Terry Gross. Coming up in just a bit, we'll hear Terry's interview with comedian Aziz Ansari. But first, we're going to listen to Terry's recent interview with Paul McCartney. McCartney spoke to Terry from his home studio in England, where he was seated at a piano he used to illustrate a few things about his music. McCartney's latest album is called Kisses on the Bottom. It features several standards, a couple of original songs, and some lesser-known songs that McCartney associates with his father's generation. McCartney's father was a musician and used to play those songs around the house when Paul was a child. Let's start with the track from which Kisses on the Bottom takes its title, I'm Gonna Sit Right Down and Write Myself a Letter, which was made famous by Fats Waller.
I'm gonna sit right down and write myself a letter and make believe it came from you. I'm gonna write words oh so sweet, they're gonna knock me off my feet. A lot of kisses on the bottom, I'll be glad I've got them. I'm gonna smile and say, I hope you're feeling better. And close with love the way you do. I'm gonna sit right down and write myself a letter and make believe it came from you.
Sir Paul McCartney, welcome back to Fresh Air. So these are songs from your father's era, and you know some of them you knew from those days. Others you learned for this album. But the songs that this type of song, did you love these songs when you were growing up? Then go through a period of distancing yourself from them, like during the Beatles era when you were all about rock and roll, before you fell in love with those songs again?
No, I didn't really. I always loved them. But, you know, when rock and roll came along and I got into the Beatles, we just thought, well, we're just doing another thing. This is just a more modern thing at the time. And it didn't dismiss the other songs at all in my mind. It just, in fact, they became sort of the basic structure of a lot of what John and I wrote. We, even though we were working in a kind of rock and roll style in a new style, the melodic structure of some of those old songs and some of the tricks that the songs used were still there in the back of our minds, both John and I, because he too was keen on this kind of music from his youth.
When you say some of the tricks that the songs used, what kind of tricks are you talking about?
As a kid growing up, I would hear something happen musically that I didn't know what it was. But I would think, that's nice. And, for instance, the changes from a minor key to a major key within a song. For instance, the song Bésame Mucho starts in a minor key. And it's, I happen to have a piano beat beside me here. It's like, Bésame, Bésame Mucho. And it goes to the major there. And I was thought, wow, something special happens when that chord hits.
Can you give me an example of one of your songs that goes from major to minor?
Yeah, My Valentine.
Oh, that's one of your original songs from the new album.
Which is one of the ones from the new album, yes. It's da-da-da-da, da-da-da-da, da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da. That's all in major. And she was right, this love of mine, my Valentine. Then it goes... And I will love her, my life. The middle is in the major key. It's just a little thing that most people wouldn't really notice it happening, but it just changes the mood. But it's an example of the tricks I was talking about. And then songs that I used to appreciate the structure of. For a song, for instance, like Cheek to Cheek, which isn't on the album, but it's an example of what I'm talking about, which would be Heaven, I'm in Heaven, And then it goes into the middle. Dance with me, arms around you, the charms around you will carry me through to heaven. And you're back at the beginning. And it was like, wow, how do they do that? And I remember as a kid thinking, I love that. I love the way that the composer's gone all that distance through the song and he comes back. I think I was talking to someone about this and saying, oh, I love that trick in the song Cheek to Cheek. And the person said, well, you do it. I said, do I? I said, yeah, in Here, There and Everywhere, one of my songs with the Beatles, it does that. Sort of after the middle, it goes, diddly, 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 and comes back to here. So it comes back to where it started. It's a very simple trick, but kind of quite effective.
What would you say is the first song where you felt, this is something new?
The Beatles song, From Me to You, which it was the middle eight. It kind of goes, if there's anything that you want, if there's anything I can do, don't me, don't you. So that's kind of straightforward. Then it goes, I've got arms along to hold you. And that, the song itself, I think, is in the key of C major. But then it goes to a G minor seventh for that middle. And that was kind of, it was one of those, oh yeah, moments. I mean, a lot of what we wrote, because we didn't read or write music, was instinctive. So we'd try a chord and we'd say, oh, that's nice. And that was the first moment I remember in our writing, John and I, was the song From Me to You. In that middle, I've got arms along to hold you. It's a kind of moody chord change.
Can you play that change just so we can hear it?
Can I play it?
Yeah, just those chords.
Yeah. No, wait a minute. I got arms along to hold you. It's just that. Hey?
Yeah, definitely. So, let me just reintroduce you. My guest is Sir Paul McCartney, and he has a new album called Kisses on the Bottom, as in the Fats Waller song. I'm going to sit right down and write myself a letter. And it's an album of songs of his father's generation's era, mm-hmm. songs that he grew up with. So you loved your father's music. Did he like your music when you were in the Beatles and you were really shaking things up? And a lot of fathers in England and in the United States didn't like the music because it seemed radical. You seemed, to the parents, you seemed like, you know, dirty and unkempt. But when you look back at the photos, I mean, like you're so well-groomed.
We're very
so
well-groomed.
Funny.
Even the Rolling Stones were well-groomed. I remember, you know, people just say, God, they're so dirty. And we had a police officer once who was helping us out of a venue. And he'd had the Rolling Stones, I think, the day before. He said, you lads are nice. He said, but those Rolling Stones, he said, oh, they're terrible, dirty and everything. And I was saying, well, what do you mean? Because we knew the guys. And we said, no, they're very clean boys. He said, oh, that Mick Jagger. He said he wore the same shirt on stage that he'd worn in the afternoon. And that was like the height of scruffiness. And it was like, excuse me, mate, I'm not sure you're right. But now, my dad, bless him, was a musician. And his dad had thought that his music, the kind that's on Kisses on the Bottom, was rubbish. He used to call it tin can music. And my dad told me this, you know, he said, and I couldn't fathom it. I think, how could you think things like Chicago, Chicago, bum, 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 bum. But I think what it was, how my dad explained it, was that his father's era, the singers were more operatic. So it was Chicago, that kind of voice that you sort of hear on the older records, or even pre-records, because, you know, my dad was born 1902, so his dad would be going back into the 1800s. But no, so consequently, my dad was more tolerant. So he'd gone through playing his tin can music. So when we brought our tin can music, he quite liked it. You know, he realized that it was quite musical. There was one funny little story, though. I've told it a lot of times, but maybe you listeners haven't heard it, which was when John and I had just finished writing the song, the Beatles song, She Loves You, and we were in the parlour of the little house we lived in Liverpool, and John and I were in one of the rooms. We went next door to where my dad was, and we played it through to him. She loves you, yeah, yeah, yeah. And he said, oh, that's very nice. He said, that's very good, son. He said, but there's just one thing. He said, couldn't you sing She Loves You, yes, yes, yes? He said, there's enough of these Americanisms around. So he said, no, sorry, Dad, it's got to be yeah, yeah, yeah. No, he was very understanding. He used to actually suggest songs for us to do from his era. There was one, Stairway to Paradise.
Oh, I'm building a stairway to paradise with a new step every day.
Paul Whiteman and his orchestra used to do it. And my dad liked that. And he thought we should do that with the Beatles. And I think, you know, we did consider it. But we thought, no, this is not us.
I want to play another song from your new album, Kisses on the Bottom. And this is My Very Good Friend, the Milkman. And it's written by Johnny Burke and Harold Spina or Spina. I'm not familiar with Harold Spina, but Johnny Burke wrote the lyrics for a lot of great songs. Pennies from Heaven. He co-wrote a lot of songs with Jimmy Van Heusen, Imagination, It Could Happen to You, Polka Dots and Moonbeams, Like Someone in Love. He wrote the lyrics to Misty. I'd never heard this song before. And it's so catchy. Tell me how you know the song.
I know I was a big fan, still am, of Fats Waller. And I had a record of his when I was a kid. You know, when you're a kid growing up in Liverpool, and I suspect it's the same anywhere in America, I suspect around the world, you don't necessarily get the record collection you want. Records just find their way to you. Someone might give you one, whatever. But I had a fairly sort of wide-ranging record collection. I would have something like West Side Story, and then Fats Waller, and then maybe Bob Dylan, and maybe Elvis Presley. It was just music I liked. Anyway, I loved Fats Waller. I loved his instrumental abilities, his vocal style, and his sense of humor. And this was one of the songs he used to do. And I always thought it was a great song. And revisiting it, it is a great lyric. You know, the second verse, particularly, my very good friend, the mailman, says that it would make his burden less if we both had the same address.
Yeah, I love that. So
I suggest that you should marry me. You know, it's a funky little song.
Okay, so this is Sir Paul McCartney from his new album, Kisses on the Bottom. And we'll hear him singing and whistling on the song, My Very Good Friend, the Milkman.
I'm a very good friend, the milkman says, that I've been losing too much sleep. He doesn't like the hours I keep, and he suggests that you should marry me. My very good friend, the mailman says, that it would make his burden less if we both had the same address, and he suggests that you should marry me. Then there's a very friendly fellow who prints all the latest real estate news, and every day he sends me blueprints of cottages with country views. All my very good friends, the neighbors say, that they've been watching little things I do, and they perceive that I love you. So I suggest that you should marry me.
That's Paul McCartney. My Very Good Friend, the Milkman, is from his latest album, Kisses on the Bottom. More with Paul McCartney after a quick break. I'm Dave Davies, and this is Fresh Air Weekend. This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Dave Davies, in for Terry Gross. Let's get back to Terry's recent interview with Paul McCartney. His most recent album, Kisses on the Bottom, collects several standards, a couple of originals, and some lesser-known songs that McCartney associates with his father's generation.
Now, when you were young, even though you were singing and you were learning piano, did you have any idea that you'd be writing songs?
No, not really. I think, you know, looking back, I think I was always musical. My dad was very musical, and I think my mom was musical too. He was the player in the family. So I think I always had a kind of musicality, and I would hear songs, and I think I could tell a good song from a bad song.
But did you not realize that you could write songs until you met John and started writing songs?
No, not really. Both of us had written a little bit before we met each other.
Mm-hmm.
And in our early conversations, you know, we'd sort of talk about music, and I'd say, well, I've written a couple of songs, you know. And he'd say, oh, yeah, so have I. So that led us into saying, well, let's write together then. I'd written, my first song I ever wrote was one called I Lost My Little Girl. And looking back on it, it might well have been about my mother because she died when I was 14. And I wrote the song round about then. But of course, you know, when you're a kid, you never think of these sort of psychiatric, you know, meanings behind what you do. You just do stuff. So I'd written this, I Lost My Little Girl. And then round about that time, I wrote the melody to what would later become a song called When I'm 64.
You wrote it that early?
I wrote that melody, yeah, very early, just bashing about on the piano. And then years later, there were a couple of things like that. And, you know, John would say to me, whatever happened to that tune? Yeah, that's a pretty good tune, you know. I'd say, okay, well, let me put some words to it.
You know, it's funny. Can I just interrupt for a second? When I'm 64 sounds so much musically like the era of my very good friend, the Milkman.
Yeah, that's right, yeah. You know, as I say, you have to remember that rock and roll hit. It wasn't always there in our lives. So that what was in our lives was the old songs, my dad's, mom and dad's era, and then the songs between that era and rock and roll, which were kind of show songs and novelty songs. There were an awful lot of novelty songs. I listen to them. I take my little girl to school and we play a CD with some of these old novelty songs, you know, and it's great. Gosh, and I remember that was a big thing when I was a kid, you know. But the point I was making was that there was this atmosphere of sort of melodic old songs or novelty songs, and then rock and roll hit. So before we got into rock and roll, before the arrival of Elvis Presley and Little Richard and all the guys, it would be natural that I would write something in the pre-rock and roll style and loving these old songs. And our aspirations also were those kind of aspirations. I mean, as a budding composer, you would be really hoping that you could get a song that Frank Sinatra would want to record. You know, that was the composer's dream. And then when Elvis Presley came around, it was then, oh, it should be Elvis, you know. So I think, you know, those kind of things, like When I'm 64, came from that period. And also the aspiration to write for that kind of market, I suppose.
Well, of course, you had it both ways, because Sinatra did your songs, and you totally transformed rock and roll. So when you first heard rock and roll, what was it that you heard, and what did it do to you musically? How did it change your thinking musically?
It was electrifying. You know, you hear people saying, I've never heard anything like that before, man. And it was that. You know, you'd hear on the radio, Elvis Presley, Heartbreak Hotel. Well, since my baby left me. It was like, oh my God, what is that? And, it, you know, you can't think, now that we know it so well, you think, well, it's Elvis Presley singing Heartbreak Hotel. You can't, there will be listeners who can imagine, who can remember that moment when you heard that. And there will be younger people now who will have a similar experience with a newer form. In fact, a lot of people with the Beatles. That's one thing people say with the Beatles. Oh my God, I remember exactly where I was when I heard I Want to Hold Your Hand. And people say, what is it? They couldn't fathom what it was, you know. So, yeah, for me, and the other record, Buddy Holly, That'll Be the Day. We definitely thought Buddy was black, and we could not figure out the guitar riff at the beginning or how he got that sound. And years later, you know, when you got in a band yourself, you would realize that it was recording techniques and the skill of the musicians, and it was just a new sound. But it blew the tops of our heads off. I mean, I heard What Did I Say by Ray Charles on the radio. I would say those three records were just completely mind-blowing. It was like, I can't believe what I'm hearing. It's very inspirational, and it makes you want to then do that. And I say, funnily enough, I've heard the same story from a lot of guys in bands nowadays who say that was what the Beatles did to them. They said, okay, now I know what I want to do with my life.
So I'd like to close with another song from your new album, Kisses on the Bottom. And this is one of the original songs that you've written, and it's called My Valentine. Tell us the story of how you wrote the song.
Well, I was divorced, and I was starting to go out with Nancy, who's now my wife. And we went on a holiday together in Morocco with my brother and his wife. And in the bar in the evening, before you go into dinner, there would be a pianist. And he was great. He was an Irish guy. And he went back to Victorian songs. Beautiful Dreamer. Da-da-da-da. You know, these were like really old songs. But I loved them, and so I was kind of steeped in the atmosphere of what he was playing on this slightly out-of-tune piano every evening. And so one afternoon, it was raining. And, you know, you're on holiday and it's raining. You've come a long way, and you don't want it to rain because you've come for the sunshine. So I said to Nancy, I said, oh, it's a bit of a pity about the rain. She said, it doesn't matter. It's fine. And I like that because it's kind of my attitude. You know, I don't really mind what the weather does. We'll make something of it. So I happened to wander along to the place where this piano was, and there was nobody around. So I got on it and started tinkling. And there were just a few waiters, and they were kind of cleaning up and stuff and coming and going. And they would just smile at me. It was basically on my own. And I started just knocking up this sort of, on the old piano, I went. Etc. My Valentine. And so I started off, What If It Rained? We didn't care. She said that someday soon the sun was going to shine. And she was right. This love of mine, my Valentine. And it kind of wrote itself. It was one of those lucky songs.
You know what I think is so odd about the song? The melody seems so sad, almost gloomy. Yeah. But the lyric, I kept thinking, oh, the lover is going to leave. Things are going to turn out bad. And they don't. I mean, the lyric is a lyric of fulfillment through love. But the melody doesn't sound that way.
Yeah, it is quite sort of somber, isn't it?
Why is that?
I don't know. It just fell out that way. You know, you can't tell when you write a song how it's going to turn out. Well, in my experience, you can't. Maybe there are composers that can. But to me, I always say it's like it's a black hole. You sit down in front of a piano or with a guitar and there's nothing there. It's a black hole. And you just start, you know, sort of, you play a chord and and that's going to sort of dictate what you're doing. That's a major chord, and that's a minor chord. So it depends what you feel like on the day. And that appealed to me, that little bit of a melody. If it hadn't, I would have just thought, oh, no, let's fish around for something else. But I think maybe because it was raining,
right.
Minor chord.
Mm-hmm.
But then the idea then of the song then suggested itself from what Nancy had said. You know, whatever it rained, we didn't care. And I liked that idea that, you know, whatever happens, we don't care. We're going to make something of it. So it became a very positive song.
No, before you get back to your rehearsal, I want to say you've been talking to us from your studio in England, your home studio, mm-hmm. and that's why you have a piano right in front of you. Would you just very briefly describe what your studio is like, where you are right now?
I will. It is in Sussex. It is on the English border. So looking out of the window, I can see the English Channel. We're up on a hill. That would have been the coastline at one point because the waters receded. So there are marshes down there. I'm in the studio. I've got a piano, all sorts of instruments and guitar amps and drum kits and things around me. My mates are in the control room and waving as we speak. and they're recording this. It's a really nice studio. It has a lot of equipment that's left over from Abbey Road. The studio manager at Abbey Road, where the Beatles recorded, was being told by those on high, accountants probably, saying, you've got to sell stuff, you've got to get rid of stuff. And he was desperate. So he rang me and he said, I'm being told to get rid of this and that. And I said, oh, no. He said, will you take it for your studio? So I said, gladly, I accepted. So I have quite a few little things that we used to use in the studio, in my studio here. So it's cluttered, but nice.
Sounds great.
So that's it. It's really is lovely, and it's a very nice day here. And I'm just rehearsing with my band. In fact, we were just rehearsing my Valentine.
Okay.
Just learning that one. Because, yeah, we're going to do some shows soon.
Well, let you get back to your rehearsal. Thank you so much for your time. Yeah. Thank you so much for talking with us.
Okay, Terry. Well, listen, you know, it's a pleasure, as always. And we love NPR. I listen to it all the time when I'm in America. And I hope you enjoy Kisses on the Bottom. And the title, of course, comes from the opening track, which is going to sit right down and write myself a letter.
With Kisses on the Bottom, I'll be glad I got him. I know, but you know, a lot of people think that somebody's going to be, it's a reference to kissing somebody's behind.
Yeah, exactly. And you know what? I don't think there's much wrong with that either.
All right.
Paul McCartney speaking with Terry Gross. McCartney's most recent album is called Kisses on the Bottom. It's a collection of standards, lesser-known songs, as well as a couple of original songs like this one called My Valentine. I'm Dave Davies, and this is Fresh Air Weekend.
What if it rained? We didn't care. She said that someday soon the sun was gonna shine. And she was right. This love of mine, my Valentine. As days and nights would pass me by, I'd tell myself that I was waiting for a sign. Then she appeared, a love so fine, my Valentine. And I will love her for life. And I will
This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Dave Davies in for Terry Gross. We're going to listen to Terry's recent interview with comic Aziz Ansari. He co-stars in the NBC series Parks and Recreation as Tom Haverford and has appeared in several films, including Get Him to the Greek and Funny People. Aziz Ansari has a new comedy special called Dangerously Delicious. His last special was on Comedy Central, but this time he's taking a cue from fellow comedian Louis C.K. and making the special available exclusively on his website. Let's start with a clip from Ansari's new comedy special, which was recorded at the Warner Theater in Washington, D.C. This part is about ethnic slurs. Ansari is of Indian descent and grew up in South Carolina. He often talks about race and ethnicity in his act.
One day, I decided to do some research on racial slurs and see if I could learn anything. And I found a very interesting article. It was titled, List of Every Ethnic Slur. And it was 21 pages long. And I read all of them. And if it's cool with you guys, I'd now like to share a few of my favorites. Now, these are racial slurs, ethnic slurs, okay? So they're offensive. They're offensive by their very nature. So if I say one or I describe one and you're offended, there's no reason to be like, oh, because we all know they're offensive. So instead, you can shut your mouth. At the same time, though, I don't want to do this bit and look at the audience and see some guy just like, yeah! Because that would be terrifying on the other end of the spectrum. So here we go, my favorite racial slurs, okay? The first one, it's defined as a derogatory descriptive phrase for a person of predominantly Caucasian ancestry with real or suspected distant Asian or African ancestry. Now, this is a pretty specific situation to need to bust out a racial slur, but if you're ever caught in a jam, all you gotta say is, you know what, man? You got a touch of the tar brush. Yeah, you heard me. You got a touch of the tar brush. This is a tar brush. This is you. You don't think I see that distant Asian ancestry in your predominantly Caucasian face?
It's Aziz Ansari from his new comedy special, Dangerously Delicious. Aziz, welcome back to Fresh Air. It's great to talk with you again.
So, thank you so much for having me.
One of the things you talk about on your comedy special that's on your website, Dangerously Delicious, is about how you're still single and you're still having problems dating even though you're on TV and friends say to you, you're on TV, you shouldn't have any trouble. And you do this whole, what am I supposed to do? Go into a bar and say, excuse me, I'm a guy on TV. And expect people that, you know, that are just going to come up to you and like volunteer. But has it changed your dateability to be a recognizable TV person?
Obviously, you know, people come up to me because they recognize stuff I've done. You know, there's no denying that. But my point in that bit was that it's not this, like, dream situation people kind of imagine in their heads. There's a lot of just, like, random dudes are like, oh, man, it's that brown guy that's on that thing. You know, like, there's that too, you know. But, of course, you know, there's women that come up to me and say, oh, you know, I enjoy your work, and I've met a lot of interesting people that way, and you know, I'm fine with it. It's so interesting because people ask about that stuff, and they're like, "Don't you think those girls are just coming up to you because you're on TV and you're a comedian?" It's like, yeah, I know that, but no one ever asks like some like good looking stud dude like, don't you think those girls are just coming up to you because of your face? Like, it's just that's not looked at as a negative. And it's like, right. Well, to me, that's worse because that guy did nothing to earn his face. He didn't, like, sculpt his nose. Like, I worked really hard and developed this career and put out a body of work. So if someone's a fan of that and they came up to me because of that, that's less shallow than going up to someone because you like their face or their sweater or whatever. You know what I mean? Like, the guy didn't make the sweater. He just bought it, you know? And so I think there's kind of this thing of, like, saying, like, oh, going up to someone because you like their work and meeting someone that way is, like, a shallow thing. But sometimes you meet people that are, like, super interesting that are just like, oh, I saw your thing. I enjoyed it. And then you start talking and you're like, oh, you're an interesting person. I enjoy your company. And I've made friends that way, you know?
So your humor on stage is self-deprecating, and I'm thinking like you're good friends with, like, you know, or good friends, I don't know, but you're friends with Jay-Z, you love hip-hop, and, you know, the hip-hop is so much about confidence and swagger and feeling like you can go up to that beautiful woman and she's just going to just, she's going to be really happy that you went up to her. Because you're the best when it comes to making love or standing up to the cops or looking good or, you know, whatever needs to be done. And I'm wondering, like, how your self-deprecating humor goes over with your hip-hop friends, because the sensibility in some ways seems pretty different.
Well, being a rapper is, like, about being cool and things like that. And being a comedian, you're not really supposed to be the coolest guy. So I think, you know, they understand it's a different type of thing, you know? And those guys are super funny. When I do hang out with them, like, we'll laugh hard at things we all say, and they have a great sense of humor. So they understand it's a different thing. I don't think they're like, oh, man, Z's isn't cool. You know what I mean? it's just a different thing to be a comedian. There's not a self-deprecating rapper. That wouldn't work. If you were a rapper that was like, I saw this girl, but I was too scared. Like, like, that doesn't work for a rapper. You can't be like, and then I took her back to my place, and she said she had a boyfriend. Like, that rapper wouldn't go very far. Because in a rap song, you want to live vicariously through them. You want to be on the jet or whatever. You want to be like, you know, and then I drove my mom's car because I can't afford my own. Terry, I think we got to do a self-deprecating rapper album. Do you make beats on the side?
Absolutely. That is what I do in the evenings.
Or maybe you could sing the hooks.
I do that too. It's really funny you should bring it up. Absolutely.
I can't afford a car.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Aziz Ansari. He has a new stand-up comedy special that he's making available as a download or streaming on his website only. And he's also one of the stars of Parks and Recreation. Now, on Parks and Recreation, you play Tom Haverford, who you know, works with Parks and Recreation Office. Why don't you describe your character?
I play a low-level government administrator that works at this Parks and Recreation Department. And kind of the character story is that he grew up in this small town, and he lives in this small town in Indiana, and he really wishes he was kind of this impresario, like, you know, Russell Simmons or Sean P. Diddy Combs, or, you know, one of these guys that just has his fingers in a lot of pies and is this big mogul. But he's in this really small town. He's too scared to go to, like, New York or L.A. to kind of really make that happen. So he kind of tries to live those dreams in the confines of this very small town. And I love working on the show, and everyone in the cast and everybody is just fantastic.
Well, actually, you know, he leaves Parks and Recreation for a while to start a media marketing business called Entertainment 720, make those mogul dreams come true.
Yeah, he in the beginning of this season, he did try to do his probably biggest swing at kind of achieving those dreams was this company called Entertainment 720, and it's called 720 because they'll travel around the world twice, 720 degrees, to make your dreams come true.
Let's play an ad that you and your partner in this company did to promote Entertainment 720. And in the commercial that you did, we won't see this, but, like, you're dancing, you're toasting with, like, these beautiful, like, brandy snifters, whatever they're called. And you're trying to look as hip as you possibly can.
I can't thank you guys enough. You made me millions of dollars.
Don't mention it. Take care.
Hey, Tom, who was that guy?
That was you, if you play your cards right. Hi, I'm Tom Haverford, one of the founders of Pawnee's hottest new company, Entertainment 720.
When Tom and I created Entertainment 720 way back in 2011, we had one simple goal in mind: create the premier multimedia entertainment production conglomerate in the world.
Mission accomplished. If you can call it entertainment, we'll handle it. Film production, television, radio, advertising.
Record production, DJing. We will create YouTube videos that your kids actually watch. I will write your tweets and your Facebook statuses.
Club promotion, personal promotion, memorial videos for pet funerals, dogs, cats, fish, tiny horses, giant lizards, you name the animal.
Visual effects for raves, laser light shows, regular light shows.
Aziz Ansari from Parks and Recreation. It's so much fun to watch him trying to be as cool as his heroes are and always just being lame and embarrassing. Instead, did you ever feel that way yourself when you were growing up?
I definitely relate to the frustration of being in a small town and wishing you were in somewhere bigger. I mean, I grew up in South Carolina in a very small town that had like 8,000 people. There was just nothing to do. Nothing cool was going on. But now I feel like with the internet and everything, you're so exposed to everything cool. And you can really get into a lot of cool stuff, even if you're just in, you know, South Carolina or in a small town. You can hear about, like, the coolest band in Brooklyn or whatever. Back when I was growing up, it wasn't like that, I don't think, as much. And I was definitely, like, frustrated. Like, it always just seemed like there was cooler stuff going on in bigger cities.
You're of Indian, the country of India ancestry. And
yes.
When you were growing up, there were probably not a lot of comics of South Asian ancestry to look to as role models. Did that matter to you?
I never saw an Indian person on TV unless it was like Gandhi or there was like a James Bond movie where he goes to India or like there's some show where they happen to go to India or they're showing a Quickie Mart guy. There was no one Indian on TV, like no one. When I did this sketch show on MTV called Human Giant around 2007, I joked around with the people at MTV. I was like, wow, it's pretty cool. I think I might be the first Indian person you've ever had on MTV. And I was half joking, but I think it may be true. Like, I can't think of ever seeing an Indian person on MTV. And I think it's really cool now. You can't avoid Indian people on TV. There's like one Indian person minimum on every like sitcom or drama. There's like some Indian guy in the office. It's really funny to me that that's the case. And even when I was coming up, even seeing like Mindy Kaling on The Office, it was great because you could point to her and be like, see, like she's a really funny character on that show and there's no jokes about her having an Indian accent or anything. It's just about her character and her personality. Even having that was like a great thing to point to. And I think now with me and Danny Pudi on Community and you know, a myriad of other people, I think it must be a little different to be a kid growing up that's Indian and seeing all these Indian people in the culture.
There's a good deed that you did that I think few people know about. There was an article in Rolling Stone about violence against gay teenagers, and after you read it, you got in touch with the person who wrote the article and offered to do a fundraiser to raise money for an organization that works with gay teens, and you hosted a comedy benefit in L.A. on behalf of a Minnesota LGBT group. Why did you decide to do that?
I heard a YouTube clip from Howard Stern where he was talking about this article. And if you haven't read the article, you should really read it. It's about bullying and particularly about this school in Minnesota where it was just really such a sad article. And I just read it and I was like, man, is there, you know, it really affected me. And it really made me sad. Like, just thinking about these kids who were, these kids were just like getting put down by all these other kids in their school, and they seem like such brilliant kids. And it just really bummed me out that the bully kids were winning, that they were letting them ruin what was special about them. And it just didn't seem fair. It just seemed like these kids were.
Were you bullied as a kid?
I wasn't, you know. I think you would think I would be. It seemed like I'd be a really easy bully target, but, you know, obviously I was made fun of here and there, but I've said this, I think I even said it to you last time I talked to you, like, you know, it was probably on par with what a fat kid dealt with. It was not, like, serious racism where, like, kids were throwing rocks at me and harsh stuff like that, or you see, like, you read these stories and stuff and you read about, like, real torment, you know, like, real kids getting really tormented. I did not have that at all. But I guess I can relate to the idea of being different from everyone else, and I can relate to people telling you you can't do something or people making fun of you because you're different, or I've seen other kids make fun of other kids for having different interests or whatever. And when I read that story, it really ticked me off that the school allowed that to happen. Basically, the school district wasn't taking a stand. It really got bad, and several kids ended up taking their own lives. It was that bad. And one kid's mom started an organization called Justin's Gift. and the writer of the Rolling Stone article. I just emailed her and I was like, hey, I read this article and it's really affected me. I just feel like I want to do something. I'll gladly do a benefit. Like, it's really easy for me to, like, put on a show and raise some money. Like, who could I raise money for? What would be the best organization? And she referred me to the Justin's Gift. And so I was doing a show that weekend, and it sold out, and we gave that money. And then I put together another show with some other comedians that I'm friends with, and we charged more for that, and it sold out. And we raised, like, $15,000, like, just doing those two shows, and we gave it to them. And, you know, I was glad we were able to do those shows and do that, and I hope it helps those kids even a little bit, because, you know, it just really bummed me out hearing about.
Well, I think it's great that you did that. So you do a lot of tweeting. You have a lot of followers. And after the Trayvon Martin story, when Geraldo made his comment about how, you know, he shouldn't have been wearing a hoodie.
Yes.
You replied with a barbed tweet. And I'll ask you to tell us the radio-friendly version of what you said?
I think what I said was, it's really appropriate to say this any day, but today in particular, F you, Geraldo. And I tweeted that, and what I failed to realize is that now, whenever there's a big news story, news outlets will take things that people tweet and quote them. As if that's, like, their statement on something. Obviously, if I was talking to, like, the Washington Post, that would not be my analysis of the event. No, I would have said something a little bit more nuanced. However, there was an article somewhere. I have it on my phone. I'll read it to you what they wrote. They wrote, the headline said something like, sorry, give me a second. I'll pull it up. It said, Geraldo Rivera says Trayvon Martin's hoodie made him a target, receives major backlash. The Fox News commentator says Martin's killer should be prosecuted, but the victim's attire put him at fault, too. Aziz Ansari responds, F you, Geraldo. I love that that was in the sub-headline for that article. Which, in that case, you know, I don't like people quoting me, you know, from my Twitter and, like, a serious news article. But in that case, it was so funny to me that I approve.
Aziz Ansari, it's been great to talk with you again. Thank you so much.
It's always a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Aziz Ansari speaking with Terry Gross. His new comedy special is called Dangerously Delicious. Fresh Air Weekend was produced by John Myers. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Audrey Bentham. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Roberta Shorrock, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Sam Brigger, Lauren Krenzel, John Sheehan, Heidi Simon, and Teresa Madden. Dorothy Ferby is our administrative assistant. Our associate producer for online media, Melody Kramer, maintains Fresh Air's website at freshair.npr.org. There you'll find links to our Twitter feed, as well as longer versions of all the interviews heard on Fresh Air Weekend. For Terry Gross, I'm Dave Davies. This is Fresh Air Weekend.